is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, June 7, 2019. I'm Buster Olney. Our producer every day is Josh McNerney. Josh, I just want to say to you, thanks for showing up today, because I think I heard you from about 100 miles away during the Boston Bruins game and the non-call happened.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Yeah, that was you last night when that non-call went down. Oh, I was thinking about you during that play. You must have been going nuts.
Yeah, I know this is a baseball podcast, and I'd be surprised if a lot of people were watching the hockey game last night, but it was a brutal non-call. And I'm genuinely not one who likes to gripe about officiating, but it was a bad call, and it's gonna be a big part of the series. Who knows if the Bruins can come back? The Blues obviously have an advantage. They earned the win. You know, it's not their fault that non-call was not made, if you follow the double negative there, but boy, it was a tough one.
Oh, we know what's going to be on your headstone if the Bruins don't win this series, you know. What a stupid non-call that was!
Yes. Yeah, it was rough.
All right. As that hockey game was going down, the Atlanta Braves were in the process of reaching a deal with Dallas Keuchel, the veteran left-hander, a free agent, has been unsigned throughout the winter and the first 2 months of this season. He will, under the terms of this deal, make $13 million for the rest of the season. The Braves played the Pirates, and Gregory Polanco went deep for Pittsburgh.
One ball, one strike pitch, and there's a high fly ball to right field. It's a warm day, but we'll take a big cup of coffee all the way to the back row of the Clemente seats. Polanco six, back-to-back Jack. Pirates lead 3-1.
And they would go on and win 6-1. That from Sports Radio 93.7, The Fan. The Padres played the Nationals. Early on, it looked like the Nationals were going to be in control.
The pitch belted deep to left field. This is way back. This is going, and it is gone. Goodbye. Into the third level of the Western Metal Supply Building. Brian Dozier with a two-run blast. Bang! Zoom goes Dozier here at the top of the first inning with his ninth home run of the year. RBIs 20 and 21, and it's the Nationals 4 and the Padres nothing.
Charlie Slows on the Nationals radio network. The Padres, however, would come back.
And Machado grounds one to shortstop. Turner is going to third, and that'll be, it'll get away. One run is in, here comes another, and Tatis, this game is tied.
Don Orsillo on Fox Sports San Diego. With that call, San Diego would go on and win 5-4. The Yankees play the Blue Jays. The Yankees are getting healthy. Aaron Hicks starting to get on a roll.
Trend continues. Hicks hammers one right field on its way out of here. Into the bullpen and gone. Aaron Hicks, his third of the year. And just like that, the Yankees lead it 4-0.
That from Bukshambi on ESPN television. The legend, after the game, spoke with Aaron Hicks. Also, David Ross involved in this interview.
2-for-4 tonight. Your swing looks locked in. I mean, that was an absolute bullet on that first pitch fastball over the right field gap. Tell me how you feel on the plate. You hit a lot of hard line drives to center, and you got that one there at the end to left side of the infield. Tell me how you're feeling.
I feel good. You know, left side's feeling really, really good right now. I feel like I'm seeing all the speed really well. Right-handed, you know, I feel like I'm just missing. But I feel like I'm seeing good pitches and getting good pitches to hit.
All right, from center field, your vantage point of Jay Happ tonight, because he did a really nice job of keeping them off balance.
Yeah, I mean, he was attacking the zone, you know, which is most important thing. And, you know, it's keeping him off balance. And, you know, that's the kind of pitcher he is, and that's what we know he can do.
Injuries for your team have been a big part of the story. Mentally, sort of what's the vibe in the clubhouse, knowing that as well as you've played, you're going to get a lot of talent back, including Didi tomorrow, Judge soon, hopefully, Stanton as well.
It's kind of one of those things where it's next man up. You know, these guys have been getting opportunities like Gio and Frazier, and they've been taking advantage of it. You know, and that's what you want guys to do when there's injuries, and, you know, that's what they've been doing. So it's awesome to see.
Boog reference, Didi Gregorius will be back in the Yankees lineup when they take on Cleveland tonight. The Red Sox were in Kansas City trying to finish off a sweep, and in the top of the sixth inning, Christian Vasquez blew it open.
Barlow sets, checks the runners, and delivers. And a drive toward right center field. Hamblin circling over, and he doesn't get it. He took a terrible route and rolls behind him, and two runs are going to score. Bogarts crosses the plate. Devers crosses the plate. Vasquez to third, and the Red Sox lead at 6-3.
Joe Castiglione, WEEI 93.7 FM. The Twins played the Indians, and man, Max Kepler had himself a day.
To begin the seventh, as Kepler swings, hammers high and deep to center. Back it goes, deep it goes, three-homer night Kepler. His second three-homer game here in Cleveland. This one to dead center. He now is 15 on the year, and the Twins get that run back and now lead 5-1.
Corey Probus on the Treasure Island Baseball Network. Yeah, three homers among four hits for Kepler in a 5-4 victory. And after the game, he spoke with Fox Sports North.
What a performance again from you in this ballpark. Another home run night. Is there something about this ballpark that brings out some pretty impressive performances from you?
I mean, last time I was in 16. But yeah, it's nice to have a night like this, you know, see the ball well. It was looking like a pin, you know, the days before, but, I mean, broke out of it, and I'm glad I could play, you know, another day.
The Rockies are coming on like gangbusters. They've been playing great of late. They're in Wrigley Field for the final game of their series against the Cubs. And Peter Lambert, a rookie, made his major league debut.
Lambert takes that deep breath, got that sign from Iannetta. Another quick breath of the pitch. Swing and a miss. Got Descalso as well for the second consecutive at bat. And he ends up, Peter Lambert, striking out the side in the seventh inning.
After 850 KOA, there's a new sheriff in town, Peter Lambert, rookie, helping Colorado beat the Cubs 3-1. The Brewers took the final game of the series against the Marlins, and that guy, Christian Yelich, did it again.
Yelich leads in home runs with 22, drives one to right.
Josh, that call was by...
Oh, I wish it could have lasted forever. Robert M. F. Euchre, 620 WTMJ.
The Brewers win that game 5-1. The Cardinals beat the Reds 3-1 with help from Paul DeJong.
There's a line drive in the left field. This has got a chance. It's at the wall. It's gone as Paul DeJong has hit a two-run homer to give the Cardinals a 3-1 lead. And Mr. Shannon, you said he was due, and due he was.
Yes, about time. His ninth of the year, and it's a big one. Put the Cardinals up 3-1 now.
And that would be the final score. That call from the Cardinals Radio Network.
Deep center field.
The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
The game of the day, a wild one between the Astros and the Mariners. Justin Verlander on the mound for the Houston Astros, trying to get career win number 214. And early on, the Astros are rolling.
That ball is driven pretty deep to left field. Malik Smith will look up, and Alex Bregman has done it. Add another one to that total compared to Nolan Arenado as Alex Bregman hits his 18th home run of the year. And the Astros now lead 4-1.
Todd Callis, AT&T Sportsnet. The Astros lead would be extended to 5-1, and then the Mariners would come back and they would tie the game. And this is what happened when Seattle was trailing 7-6.
One run Houston lead here in the 10th. Here we go. Pitch.
Deep to right, and we have a tie ball game again. Omar Narvaez. He ties his career best with his ninth home run. What a bomb that was. 7-7 game here in the 10th.
Dave Sims on Root Sports. In the top of the 14th, Miles Straw led off for the Astros.
There's a ball hit pretty well to right field, sending Santana back, and he can't find it. It's off the wall, and Straw can fly. Miles Straw motoring around second base. He will head first slide into third with a leadoff triple in the 14th.
And that would lead to Tim Kirkjian's favorite play.
The 2-0. And that's lifted to right field toward the line. Long run for Santana toward the corner. He makes the catch. Straw tags and scores, and the Astros lead it 8-7 in the 14th. So Yuli Gurriel with his second RBI of the game and his 27th of the season.
A game-winning sacrifice fly right there from Yuli Gurriel. The Astros win the game 8-7. Robert Ford on KBME 790 AM. Today we've got a conversation with Tony Gwynn Jr., and I'll ask him if he thinks his dad would have hit 400 in 1994 if not for the player strike, and what he believes is different about the Dodgers' Cody Bellinger this year. But first, the Braves make what could be a big move. Let's get to it.
All aboard. It's the Rabbit Train with Carl Ravitch.
And the Rabbit Train, of course, this weekend, I think headed to Chicago, right, Carl? Yeah, he fired up about that?
Yes, it is. It's on the fast track to Chicago. Once again, Rabbit Train expecting some mild turbulence, chance of forecasted showers. Last week we had the same thing, nailed it, Yankee Stadium. For some reason, you guys actually continued to play in a lightning storm, which I can't understand. But the game got in. I'm going to anticipate this week the game gets into. So let's just be confident that the Ravi train arrives on time. We do our Baseball Tonight Sunday Night Countdown right into RBO and the rest of the Sunday Night crew for the game.
Yeah, well, it was a few weeks ago when we were in Wrigley Field and they had, what, 4 tons of soil that they had to remove from from the infield because of all the rain they played in it. I fully expect that they will play on Sunday night, no question. Cardinals against the Cubs. All right, let's talk about Dallas Keuchel signing with the Atlanta Braves. It's actually not official as you and I speak. He still has to pass a physical, which, by the way, is not a done deal. Because there are concerns about his physical well-being, but assuming that it gets done, he's going to get paid $13 million for 2019 for the rest of this season. Carl, I love this deal from the Braves' perspective. If you look at their rotation, Mike Soroka, Julio Teheran, Max Fried combined, 16-8 with a 2.89 ERA. All other Braves starters, 28 starts, a 6.52 ERA. I love them basically spending cash, not having to give up prospects in order to potentially upgrade their rotation, give them a little bit more experience. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that the little bit more experience is a real big part of this. I know, as you know, there are other teams trying to get Keuchel. If you look around at the recent World Series winners, many of them had good young pitching, but they also had that veteran. I think about the Phillies with Arrieta. I think that Keuchel can serve that role with the Braves team that has great young pitching. He knows McCann. He can talk about World Series. He can talk about pitching at Yankee Stadium if it comes down to something like that. I think there's just tremendous value in him. They have power arms. He's obviously a contact guy. I think he's going to be motivated. Look, he was in a position to end up going to a team that was going to compete for a playoff spot and or a World Series title. So the suitors were exactly, if you're in this position, which is not a comfortable position to be in, I know I've read your stuff. He sacrificed money from the beginning by not accepting the deal that the Astros had originally put on the table, but he finds himself now thrust into a playoff race on a great team with people he knows as a leader, which are probably some of the boxes he wanted to check by signing with whatever team he would. He's accomplished that. He's going to miss half the season, but I'm interested to see if, and we had this conversation with guys like Clemens before, even David Ortiz when he was pondering retirement, why not join a club in July and help carry them through? Because we really need you strong and healthy in September and October. If this is this is potentially a way that free agents operate, and perhaps, and I know, and you know, Boris will spin this really positively for his client. So maybe there's another side to it, which is just keep an eye on whether this is something that occurs again. From the Braves' perspective, love it. I agree with you. The money's fine. They need a guy like that, or they'd love to have him. They get him. I think it's a win-win for the Atlanta Braves, and it makes that division and those two teams that made these moves, the Braves and Cubs, stand out to me, along with the Dodgers.
Yeah, and we'll get to Dallas Keuchel's, the handling of this from Scott Boras in a moment. But first, during the course of the wintertime, Alex Anthopoulos, the general manager of the Braves, got a lot of criticism because the Phillies were loading up, the Mets spent a lot to load up, the Nationals spent on Patrick Corbin. And I remember in spring training, talking with Freddie Freeman about the decisions that the Braves front office made. He goes, look, I love the fact that we kept all of our pitching. No other team has more young pitching. And the Braves decided, you know what, we're going to keep that ammunition. We have all these guys, but we don't know exactly who's going to turn out. We're going to give them time to develop. They signed Josh Donaldson on a one-year deal. They now have Keuchel on a one-year deal, and they still have all those prospects. And as they move forward, and clearly at some point they're probably going to try to upgrade their bullpen before the trade deadline, I think they're going to wind up this is all going to turn out very well for them because he wasn't too aggressive and didn't overreact and trade two pitching prospects to get a veteran starter. I like that from their perspective. I agree with you, Carl, about the Braves in the National League East. Look, I picked them to go to the World Series before the year started. I feel better about that pick now.
I would agree. I think what Alex did and the Braves have done, and maybe other teams will do so, who don't sign Bryce Harper, who don't make that big deal for the veteran starter and give up two-thirds of their great pitching farm system pieces, is they used the first 3 months of the regular season to see where they were going to be at. And if they were improving but not nearly in the race in the East, they don't make this decision to sign Keuchel. They have seen the first April, May, and June begin to play out and say, we are as good as those teams. We can compete. Now we fortify. And that's where Dallas Keuchel comes in. We are fortifying. But they allowed themselves not to commit $13 million or whatever the exact figure turns out to be until they knew what they were. And as you said, Soroka and Fried, Foltynewicz hasn't really been great yet. You add Keuchel to that mix, you assume Foltynewicz comes back. They're really good, and you're right. Now they're in a position like the Phillies, like the Cubs, who I thought had to do something because they are in that win-now window that they had to do something. And that's why, to your point, I think Alex played this beautifully. Let's let the kids show us what they got, We've told Freddie Freeman we're going to be good in 2 or 3 years. Well, that clock got accelerated.
Let's talk about this situation from Keuchel's perspective as a pitcher. You mentioned Brian McCann. He goes to the National League East where the offenses aren't going to be as strong, so you love it from that perspective. I will say this, Carl. Man, is he going to be under a lot of pressure to perform right away. The report came out last night that he is expected to start in the minor leagues this weekend. He's been throwing simulated games, but there is no margin for error for Dallas Keuchel as he comes back. Because under a one-year contract, of course, the strategy would be that he would go to sign with a team this summer and then go into the free agent market in the fall. And if he doesn't perform well here in these last 3 months of the season, he's going to get buried in free agency. And we've seen so many of these guys who've signed the middle of the year, position players, pitchers who've really struggled. Kendry Morales talked to Ken Davidoff of the New York Post the other day about his situation 2014. And said, look, I was behind. I just couldn't catch up. Greg Holland talked with Bob Nightingale about signing with the Cardinals on opening day last year. And he said, I everybody else was way ahead of me. And that's what Keuchel's walking into. But he's got to perform right away, given his contractual situation.
I agree with the premise. He has to perform, especially for his own sake and moving forward. I also look at Keuchel as I do Kimbrel. I mean, they may be not at their peak given their ages, but they are coming off seasons in which they have been really, really good, bordering on excellence. And I don't think because he's not a power pitcher and he relies on off-speed stuff and getting ground balls that it's going to dramatically impact him. I could be wrong, but I look at Keuchel as more of a better bet to return and have success than I would some of the people you just mentioned. And I just wouldn't put him in a Kendrys Morales class. I think Dallas Keuchel has, 3-4 good years left. And given the way that he pitches, which is to contact, which flies in the face of every other organizational decision when it comes to pitching, I think it's again a better bet than some of the other folks that you mentioned. I think his experience, I think his ability to pitch on the big stage, he was the guy that went into Yankee Stadium and absolutely shoved against the Yankees. I think he's a high risk a high reward, low risk guy when it comes to a situation like this.
All right, let's talk about the contract and how this played out. Look, I feel like when you look at this situation, the bottom line is that it's like talking about a pitcher who allowed 9 runs in the inning and a third. Scott Boras screwed it up. Because when you sort of look at the way it played out, where we had various options at different parts of the offseason, it was kind of like one of those shows, like Let's Make a Deal or Deal or No Deal or Price is Right. So as the offseason began, Carl, what Scott Boras was telling teams was that he wanted 6 or 7 years, $25 to $30 million a year for Dallas Keuchel. And teams that were interested potentially in Keuchel said, okay, that's too high for us. And you know the current front offices are very bloodless. They have no emotion. They basically attach what they consider to be a value to a player. And when the numbers don't fit, they just move on to the next guy. And this was after Scott had turned down on Dallas's behalf a qualifying offer from the Astros at $17.9 million. Then, in early March, the Astros re-engage because Keuchel is still out there. They offer him 1 year at 15 or 2 years at 24. Options there because the Astros, like a lot of other teams, have concerns about Dallas and whether or not he's holding up physically. The concerns about his shoulder, specifically within the Astros organization, they turn that down as well. And so what we wind up with is now Dallas in an accelerated situation. As we talked about, boy, he's got to perform right away, and he gets $13 million, which is $5 million less than what he could have gotten in the qualifying offer. Who knows what he could have gotten if early in the offseason there had been a lot more engagement with teams. I personally think he could have wound up with a $60 or $70 million deal. I don't think teams looked at him as being, you know, someone who's going to get paid like a Max Scherzer, but there certainly was interest in him, and boy, it absolutely backfired. That's my view. What about you?
Look, I think he's pretty pissed off about the fact that he hasn't pitched yet. I think that edge will perhaps serve him well moving forward here this season. I think you have to take all of these situations and put them not in a vacuum, but remove them from the vacuum. The idea, again, this has to do with his own personal financial situation. Did they overplay their hand, like Craig Kimbrell asking for 5 years and he asked for 6? Sure, but did he need to get $60 million to live a life that he wants to live for his family? Probably not. I think if he were more desperate, then he would have signed earlier. I think at some point he assumes the driver's seat, and these are decisions he's making, and he can stand on the hill of, I want to get what I believe my fair market value is, and then at some point he gets a little more desperate and says, I'm not too worried about my fair market value, or the market has been redefined for me, and as a result, I'm going to take this deal, and I believe in this organization, on this team, I'm going to pitch in September and October, and I'll increase my value for next year. So I think that occurred for Dallas Keuchel. But I look at, we had this conversation yesterday. I look at the Jed Lowry, DJ LeMahieu situation. You know, the Yankees signed LeMahieu for basically the same average annual value as Jed Lowry. One obviously hasn't played, and the other is an all-star. So when it comes to these sort of decisions that these teams are making, look, the Yankees look brilliant for signing LeMahieu. The Mets look awful for signing Lowry. In the Keuchel case, look, the Astros may end up looking really good for not signing him. But if he has great success, then the Braves will look brilliant for doing it. There's not, I don't think you can throw a blanket over any of these, but I agree with your premise that he is not happy with the way that things turned out given his original demands. And whether this is a lesson for free agents, left-handed pitchers who are of the age of Keuchel, then we've now redefined or relearned what the market will tolerate. But again, Keuchel could afford to be in this position financially. It may turn out to be a big boon to him. It may be a nightmare. The Astros may look brilliant. The Astros may look foolish. All those things are still in play for me.
All right, two more for you. Joe Maddon told reporters yesterday that Craig Kimbrell, of course, newly signed by the Cubs, could be back in 3 weeks. Carl, I mentioned yesterday in the podcast, I don't think this is a good way for teams to look at it, given the struggles that we've seen from players who've signed in during the course of the season. I think it's a lot better just to bring in Craig Kimbrell as if he's a guy at the beginning of spring training and let him chart his own path and let him, his stuff and his readiness tell you what a timeline is. And I know, look, Joe was probably just trying to be helpful to the reporters who are asking him how long till Kimbrell comes back. And he was given a best case scenario. But I do think that whether it's Keuchel or whether it's Kimbrell, I think teams should just put the blinders on. Don't worry about putting an artificial timeline on it. Don't worry about rushing the guy in. Just let the guy's progress, what you're seeing from him with his stuff, as you would in spring training, tell you when he's ready. What do you think?
I would agree. And I'm glad, I'm glad we got to the Kimbrell thing. Look, the biggest and most ripe target of the people that sign late is clearly on Craig Kimbrell. There's a significant difference between Kimbrell and Keuchel. One preserves and finishes out victories. The other starts a game. We have seen the role of starter be reduced to five innings, and let's get it to our bullpen. In the Cubs' case, they have blown so many leads this season that the pressure is now squarely on Craig Kimbrell. And I am worried, given what we saw last year, that the expectation is going to be he is a savior. And he is not going to be a guy that when he comes in from the bullpen doors, you say to yourself, uh-oh, which Craig Kimbrell are we getting today? And I can't imagine the pressure that's on Craig Kimbrell. He's in a city where they expect to win a World Series. He's on a team in which some of the stars have proven to be MVP-type players who are having those types of seasons again, or at least beginning to, in Baez and Bryant. And, of course, we know what Rizzo can do. You got a manager whose seat, if not hot, is certainly warm. Theo and Jed have put this organization on notice. We have given you what we believe are the tools to get yourselves into an NLCS and play the Dodgers, or play the Braves, and beat them and get to a World Series. And for the most part, we cannot afford to have games blown anymore. We invested in a guy we think is as good as anybody that's going to close games, and that's Craig Kimbrell. And if he fails, it is going to be real easy to look at who is the guy that made a mess here. And it's going to be the guy that's being paid to close games. And that to me is the ultimate pressure cooker. And look, the guy has the ability to do it, but if we're talking about Keuchel and Kimbrell and comparing level of stress and pressure, it's not even close.
No, and what I heard a lot yesterday from other teams was, boy, it told you a lot that the Boston Red Sox haven't even engaged him, not during the offseason, not during the early spring when their bullpen wasn't doing very well. They saw what they saw last year. They saw him struggle to throw strikes. They saw the 5.01 ERA after the All-Star break, and they had a pass. So it'll be very – I agree with you. It's going to be absolutely fascinating to see what happens. Last one for you. We had a conversation with Tim the other day about this idea that Tom Brady would like to get a trademark on the nickname Tom Terrific, which – as you know, for baseball fans, has a special meaning already because that's what they called Tom Seaver, a Hall of Famer. Yesterday, Tom Brady was asked about that whole thing. Give a listen.
It's unfortunate. I was actually trying to do something because I didn't like the nickname, and I wanted to make sure no one used it because some people wanted to use it. So I was trying to keep people from using it, and then it got spun around to something different than what it was. So good lesson learned, and try to do things a little different in the future.
Tom Brady, the greatest football player in the history of the NFL, no question about it. And as I heard that, Carl, I was like feeling the same way I did when I talked to my son about the homework he didn't do, and he tells me something, and I go, that made no sense what he just said right there.
Yeah, that was troubling because that name has been used since, you know, the late 60s and 70s. It's gone. We're not gonna build a new car and call it a Corvette. That's already been used. It's not as if no one's ever used that before. So that was a swing and a miss. And I think by him acknowledging, look, I made a mistake, I think that's sort of an acknowledgement of, Yeah, this was a complete total miss. I know who, or I've been told who Tom Seaver is. That's Tom Terrific. That's the end of the conversation. You don't ever have to worry about it. You should not be referred to as Tom Terrific, even though you're terrific at what you do. That's not your name.
Josh, what did you think of the explanation being a Patriots fan
and a longtime
Tom Brady defender?
Totally buy it. I think, he's clearly telling the truth about what happened. I think he's just trying to be a good citizen and make sure that nobody abuses the name out of respect to Tom Seaver. So I think he did the right thing.
Yeah, good sell.
Oh my goodness. All right, Ravi, I'll see you in Chicago.
See you Sunday. All right, bud. Bye-bye.
Tony Gwynn Jr. played 8 years in the big leagues. He's an analyst for Fox Sports San Diego and also does broadcasting on the Padres radio network. He and Chris Ella hosted a talk show on the Padres flagship, 97.3 The Fan, which runs from 3 to 7 Pacific, Monday through Friday. Anthony, how you doing?
I'm good, Buzz. How about yourself?
So I've told you that the reason why I have to call you Anthony is because when I covered your dad, you were 11, 12 years old, run around the clubhouse, and he was always called you Anthony. But I never told you the backstory on why I absolutely have to do what your dad did. When your grandfather passed away, I did a story on him, and I talked to a lot of people about your grandfather. And so many of them said, well, Charlie Gwynn's, you know, he was great here, and this is what was great about him. And so I wrote this story, and I referred to him as Charlie. And, man, that chapter, your dad was not happy about that. And he made it so clear, like, my dad liked the name Charles. He did not like being called Charlie. So after that, I was totally afraid of your dad, which is why I have to call you Anthony.
That's fine. You know what's funny is that everybody who was around during that time at Qualcomm or Jack Murphy, whatever you want to call it, they all call me Anthony. So people who are still around Petco that were from that age, they all call me Anthony. So it doesn't bother me. I like the name myself. So
very nice. Okay, so let's talk about the 2019 Padres first. Clearly a year of progress. What are you seeing in this team?
I see a team that has made significant strides. First and foremost, defensively, especially in the infield. Tatis Jr. is going to come off the DL today, it sounds like. And you could argue one of the best left sides of the defense of the field in all of baseball. I think the right side is not too shabby either. I mean, whether it's Hosmer or Kinsler, Gray Garcia has filled in nicely. That's where the biggest improvement has been made. Obviously, you bring a guy like Manny Machado onto your squad, it changes the dynamic, not only in your lineup, but in your locker room. You know, Eric Hosmer is going to always be the guy that is going to give you the good sound bites for the media and also is a very talented player. But when it comes to that particular part, bring a guy like Manny Machado, it's a game changer. And so the offense has been up and down this year. The pitching has been terrific, but they're starting to run into some complications because so many guys are so young and have some innings limitations. So overall, though, you just see a much better baseball team that the Padres have thrown out on the field this year.
How good is Fernando Tatis Jr. going to be, you think, at his best?
I think he has a chance to be a perennial all-star. I mean, this kid is he's just exciting to watch. Even when he's not getting hits, he's just on base. He's causing all kinds of headaches for pitchers. You know, I don't think people understand that how fast Fernando Tatis Jr. is. He's one of the quicker guys in baseball. His defense speaks for itself. He's a talent. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I think one of the things that's unique about Fernando is the fact he's grown up in the locker room. So I think that's a clear advantage because you walk in and you're not necessarily googly-eyed, and he knows what to kind of expect. So he walked in, and from the moment he walked into that locker room, the energy that the other guys pick up from him, it's noticeable. It's a noticeable immediately, and I think that's the one thing that's been missing from this Padres squad since he's been, you know, on the DL is the fact that energy, that youthful that he brings to the table has been missing, and I think that's hurt the Padres to some aspect.
So I got to follow up on that. You mentioned about, you know, being the son of a big leaguer. You obviously can speak firsthand to it. I worked with Eduardo Perez. I work with him now. Aaron Boone, of course. I always felt like that when you talk to guys who are the sons of major leaguers, it's amazing the comfort level when they're in the big leagues, and we shouldn't be surprised by it, but I feel like your heart rate's at 60, whereas a lot of other players are at 120 and they're trying to bring it down. Why do you think there's such an immediate comfort level?
When you grow up in a locker room, you're used to being around that. Even though it's not necessarily pertaining to you, you get a chance to watch every guy that's being interviewed. You get to see how they go through it. You get to see how they handle media. You get to see the dynamic of the whole relationship between player and media. And I think obviously you're exposed to it. You're probably asked some questions at a young age that most kids at that point aren't being asked. And it's you know how it is. It's the same thing in radio. You get more reps, the more comfortable you become at it. And I think guys who are sons of big leaguers, they have that advantage to themselves already.
Yeah, to the point that if I were running like a draft room and, you know, you had one guy on the board is the son of a big leaguer and the other isn't, it's a tiebreaker for me. You look what the Blue Jays are doing. It's like every guy they gets called up is, you know, it was someone who had a father who played in the big leagues. This year, Chris Paddock has been so good for the Padres. What distinguishes him in your eyes?
His makeup. I mean, very rarely do you get a guy his age with little to no experience at the big league level have the belief that he has in himself. It's one of those things that it kind of takes you back a little bit because you just aren't used to seeing, you know, a guy his age really feel as strongly about his game. You just don't see guys like that. It's a very rare thing. Then you add to the fact that he's talented. I mean, he has feel for a changeup that is really something you don't see at a guy his age. And he's confident. And when you're confident at the big league level, that goes a long way. You got to have the talent. And I think he's starting to hit that rookie wall a little bit. He struggled his last two starts out, but all in all, I mean, the Padres have to be very, very pleased with what they've seen from him so far. And it's not just him. I mean, there are a bunch of these young guys, whether it's Chris Paddock, whether it's Joey Lucchesi, whether it's Eric Lauer. I mean, all five starters are, you know, really young. Nobody's older than 25. So when you take that into consideration, the Padres have done a good job of stocking that farm system. I think everybody's noted that, but now you're starting to see why they put so much emphasis on makeup. AJ Preller has been a stickler for that since he's been here. He wants guys that want it. He wants guys that understand where they are, and these guys do. They believe it, especially as it pertains to Chris Paddock.
Speaking of sons of big leaguers, Cody Bellinger is unbelievable this year. He clearly has taken a big step forward. You know hitting. What looks different in your eyes to a player to this point, probably the National League MVP?
The biggest thing that stands out to me with Cody is, it is probably the most simple thing, you probably heard it a lot, is the fact that he's cut down when he gets to two strike. He's one of the best two-strike hitters in all of baseball right now. And that's saying a whole lot, considering 2 years ago in a World Series, the Astros had his number. They knew they could go to that slider at any given time, and he was going to swing right over the top. He got a little bit better last year, but kind of regressed towards the end of the year. But this year, the one thing that stands out to me is when he gets to two strikes, he cuts down on his swing. He almost goes to a shorter, like Chase Utley type swing, and to me, a young guy making that adjustment just tells me he wants to be as good. He wants to maximize everything he possibly can with his skill level.
Yeah, he looks like he's swinging a tennis racket when he gets in those situations right now with how he's going down to get the ball sometimes.
I've seen him go deep with that tennis racket like swing. That's a great comparison. It's like a two-hand backhand that he's using almost with two strikes, and he's having a lot of success. I admire him because it would have been very easy to have the year he had, and we see it all the time, for him to just settle. But he didn't. And I credit Dave Roberts a little bit, because at the beginning of the year, he pretty much issued a warning. Not really a warning, but he issued a challenge to a lot of guys who were complaining about not being out there every day. Basically said, you're going to have to hit lefties and righties, and you're going to have to show me that you belong in the lineup no matter what. And to his credit, Cody Bellinger's done that. Kike Hernandez has done that for the most part, and those guys have been in the lineup almost every day.
And it feels like, when I've been around the Dodgers, it feels like that team is absolutely on a mission after losing the last two World Series. What's your sense?
Yeah, no, I get the same sense. It's a much more business-like year for them this year. Where, as the past, it was like they knew they were the most talented, and they just kind of freelanced their way through the regular season. But this year, there is purpose almost behind everything that they're doing. I would say that this is the toughest Dodger team that they put together in the 6 years that they've won this division.
All right, Anthony, I got to ask you about something that happened in your playing career. September 29, 2007, you come up as a pinch hitter for the Milwaukee Brewers, and the guy in the mound, Trevor Hoffman, the Hall of Fame closer for the Padres, and you rip a triple, you tie the score. The two teams go into extra innings. The Padres lose that day, and the next day they lose, and then a tiebreaker is required, and the Rockies wind up winning that game. And as I watched that play out, you know, again, I saw you around the clubhouse at 11, 12 years old, and Trevor was in there too, great person, and I thought, man, how strange would that feel? And so what do you remember about that, and did you and Trevor ever talk about that?
Yeah, we talked about it a bunch by now. But what I remember most about that at bat was that I felt more prepared for that at bat than I had ever been prepared for any at bat in my life. And it was really because I had watched Trevor for so long. I probably watched more of Trevor than he's watched of himself at that point, because I was there for all those games. I was there for his rise up to being one of the greatest closers of all time. And, you know, one of the things my dad was really big on, if I was to go to the stadium with him and be with him for the day, I had to be paying attention. I had to be learning something every day. And my dad was a stickler about just paying attention to your surroundings. So when Trevor came in, a lot of times it was my focus was on how he was getting guys out. And obviously, it became known that the changeup was one of the best pitch he had in his arsenal. And what I learned over the years watching him is that it didn't matter how many times he threw a pitch. He was going to do whatever it took to get the out. And I had paid attention, obviously, to the at-bats before me, where he threw like six straight changeups to Lance Nix. And I just kind of felt comfortable about that at-bat. And, you know, but at the big league level, if you can have some comfort and some confidence going into the bat, that's half the battle.
So what did he say to you when you guys talked about it?
I mean, we never really got into details, but he one of the main things that stood out was that, you know what, you did your job right there. It wasn't a bad pitch. It was a good changeup. It was down. I just was better on that particular pitch than he was. And because of that, I ended up, you know, eventually knocking them out of the playoffs. I had to fly back on the same plane with John Moores, who was the owner at the time, because that was my ride back to San Diego. So that was a little bit of an awkward flight, but it's the biggest hit in my career, so I'll never forget it.
All right, last one for you. One of the years I covered your dad was 1994. He finished the year 394. The strike happens. I'll always believe that he would have hit 400 that year. He was red hot. The knee that gave him so many problems was in good shape. He told me in that last road trip that they went through Chicago and Houston, he was like, we go down the stretch and I'm breaking out the seven grains of pain against everybody. That was his favorite bat. And he only used it against guys who threw breaking balls, as you know, because he didn't want it broken. But he was focused down the stretch. What about you? What do you think?
I 100% agree. It was hard to get my dad to ever admit things like that, but, you know, after that year, the further he got away from it, the more comfortable he was saying, I would have definitely have done it. And the interesting, you brought up the seven grains of sand. I had kind of forgot about it until I started doing some research about it recently. And I remember, you're right, he didn't use that bat until that, like, last week of the season. And that's how locked in he was. A lot of people who are making the run at 400 peak early, and it's like a gradual drop-off. Whereas my dad was actually rising as the season was ending. I mean, in order to move your batting average up 20 points in July, you got to be on a tear because you've had so many at-bats at that point. And that's the one thing that sticks out most to me is how unbelievably hot he was. If he seemed like he was getting two hits a night, he had about a three-game span where he had three-hit games. And I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. I'm positive he would have done it. It just sucks that we'll never know, right?
No, and I tell you what, two things about, you know, the question about someone hitting 400 is always, you know, how would they have handled the pressure? Your dad would have loved it. You know who else would have loved it? Ted Williams would have loved it. He would have been at every game cheering your dad on.
He would. That was the first year my dad, you know, they had had the conversation. Him and Ted had had that sit down with Bob Costas. And that was the first year he got a chance to put some of those things he talked about with Ted into play. And it just came in, the hits came in the garage. First time he really started turning on the ball and hitting balls out of the ballpark. And I could just see from that point on, he was a different hitter from 94 on. Even considering all the success he had prior to that, he was a much better hitter from that year to the end of his career.
Oh, 100%. Anthony, always great to talk with you. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Buster, we're almost at the finish line for the week. But first, we have some good Bleacher Tweets here. This one from Corey Rukert at CoreyR_12. Corey says, Buster, should the Reds look to trade Yasiel Puig regardless of their record, with Scooter Gennett coming back and Dietrich needing at-bats?
Nope, I keep him. I keep him for the depth. And on top of that, we've seen this demonstrated in the free agent market, in the trade market. I don't think there would be much value for Puig anyway.
Okay, fair enough. Christian Zylstra is next at KDCR Chizzy. How do you see the Carlos Carrasco situation impacting Cleveland's willingness to shop Trevor Bauer near the deadline?
I think they're going to shop him. I think they're going to trade him because the fact is that he has more value to other teams if you trade him this summer because he could impact two potential pennant races rather than one. So I think they'll wind up moving him either way, regardless of what happens with Carlos Carrasco.
Next up, Reggie Deal at BaseballNerd07. Buster, when we look back in 10 years, will one story of the modern analytic revolution be that teams valued prospects too much at the expense of taking on known commodities to try and win in the present?
And you do hear that from executives. They say, boy, prospects are overvalued right now. But we have seen examples where teams didn't. They tried to win. You remember the Cubs, 2016. Theo Epstein came out and said, look, we're making the deal for Rawlis Chapman in an effort to win the World Series. You saw the Indians pay heavily to get Andrew Miller, and they wound up playing the Game 7 of the World Series. And then the next year, the Astros jumping on Justin Verlander and giving up the prospects at the 24th hour to finish that deal, push it across the line. So I do think there are teams that are willing in the right circumstances to give up top prospects.
A couple more here. We got this one from CrossFit School of Sweat at School of Sweat. If the Kimbrel deal doesn't end up working out for the Cubs, and School of Sweat says he doesn't think it will, let's say after that, Bryant eventually leaves, and they don't win another World Series during his time, will it hurt Theo Epstein's reputation and legacy, or will it even matter since he built one winner in Chicago?
Nah, he's Teflon. Kind of like Scott Boras' Teflon, right? Scott's had so many huge contracts that he's made, record-setting contracts, that you just don't see people in our industry criticize him. And I think for the same reason, look, Theo is going to the Hall of Fame. He's going to go down in history as the greatest general manager ever because he hit a Mount Everest that nobody else in a K2, nobody else can match.
Right. Yeah,
he did it with the Red Sox, and he did it with the Cubs.
That's exactly
no
right.
No one else can ever touch that. So even if the Kimbrel thing doesn't work out, Theo's fine. He can continue to write his speech at the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, Craig Kimbrel's arm could fall off on the mound, and the Cubs could go 0-162 next season, and Theo would be just fine. Let's close it out with this one. Harry loves sports. He sure does. He's also at Not Camera One. Wants to know, which pitch would you want to have as your best pitch? a Chapman fastball, a Moe cutter, a Kershaw curveball, or a Tim Wakefield knuckleball?
Yeah, I'm biased because I covered Rivera and I wrote 1,000 stories about his cut fastball and the impact, and that was a lot of fun. Kept track of how many bats he broke. And on top of that, his cutter, Josh, reminds me of the slider I used to throw in wiffle ball.
Oh, yeah?
Very similar pitches, yeah.
Okay. Did you snap a lot of wiffle ball bats? Did you?
I scuffed them.
There you go. We'll count it. Yeah, it's Moe's cutter. It has to be. Keep those Bleacher Tweets coming next week. Use the hashtag Bleacher Tweets.
One last thing.
You heard Tony Gwynn Jr. make reference to that great interview that Bob Costas did, Legend to Legend, with Tony Gwynn and Ted Williams. Well, here's a very small portion of that. I would encourage you to go on YouTube and find the rest of it because it is outstanding.
Tony, there is no greater student of hitting in baseball today than you. You're legendary for having all of your at-bats cataloged on videotape. Go back and look at them when you're going to face that pitcher again, and all the hours in the batting cage under the stands in addition to the regular BP. I would imagine somewhere in your long study of hitting, you've gone over the theories of Ted Williams.
Oh, no question. You know, just sitting here listening to him speak, you know, I all ears. I saw, you know, that's, I think in order for me to be successful, I've had to listen to people. I've had to take little bits and pieces of everybody that I know that's played the game. I've read books, I've looked at video, and somehow try to incorporate some of their theories into what I do. And Ted Williams' book was the first book that I ever read, The Science of Hitting. And I really wasn't, early on, I wasn't really interested in the words. I was very interested in the little baseball picture, the little baseball box.
I can still see it.
On the back of the magazine. And with Ted's balls, you know, he had that one little square on the outer part of the plate that he really didn't hit the ball that great with, but the rest of it, there was 300s everywhere. And as I started to play big league ball, I flipped that around. I turned it inside out. I was always strong on a ball in the outer third and kind of weak on a ball in the inner third. And so that's when I went back and got the science of hitting and started reading through on how to hit that ball inside. And, you know, this year I had my best year. I felt like I could control both sides of the plate. But that's what hitting is all about. It's not about taking your own abilities. It's about listening to people who've been in the same situation before and had success.
But everything we're talking about here, and you give him all the credit in the world, so do I, for wanting to better himself and going out and practice and everything else. But in the book I wrote, I did the same thing. But in the book I wrote, I closed it by saying, to be successful as your abilities are there, and you've got great ability, is how smart you are at the plate.
Yeah.
And it's from here up, 50% of it. So if you don't guess, you're not using a big, big factor. What about when you get the count 3-0? He might not hit 3-1, 2-0. And or a pitcher that when he throws it, he said, geez, I hope you can get that over, you know. and so right away you take a little more advantage. Now, in order to pull, you might have to get up in the plate. Dare him to try to get it by you. Dare him. And okay. And the best thing that ever happened to me was when a pitcher hit me on the fist inside. I never felt bad about that. I knew that if he hit me in the inside, that I was waiting pretty good.
Yeah.
Second thing, what does the pitcher think immediately? He says, you can pitch him inside. That's a way to pitch him. That's where baseball history's made, from the middle in. You know? And the pitchers are not the brightest guys in the field. So you got to take advantage of deliveries, patterns, and of course it all relates back to how well you see the ball against this guy. Some of the best pitchers I ever hit at, I could see them like gangbusters, and they were the fastest pitchers I ever hit at, but I could see them good. And it's that herky jerky little guy that you can't pick up and never does the same thing twice, and has a little life on his ball. Those are always tough guys.
That's it for today. My thanks to Anthony Gwynn and to Carl Ravitch and to Josh McRae, who produces podcast every day. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.